Hi, this is Christopher Perrin with Inside Classical Education. On this podcast program, I interview a variety of leaders, administrators, and educators on topics relating to classical Christian education and its ongoing recovery and renewal in the 21st century. Archives of previous interviews can be found at our blog and podcast site at www.insideclassicaled.com. Hi, this is Christopher Perrin. Thanks for loading this audio clip featuring an interview of James K.A. Smith, professor of philosophy at Calvin College and the author of the book Desiring the Kingdom, Worship, Worldview, and Cultural Formation. This interview will last about 45 minutes long and consists of about 12 to 13 separate questions that Jamie answered while being interviewed on campus at the Geneva School of Orlando, Florida. Participating in the interview were Headmaster Bob Ingram at Geneva and educators Kevin Clark, Ravi Jain, and Grant Broderick, all who teach at the Geneva School of Orlando. In his book Desiring the Kingdom, Smith contends that before we humans are cognitive, rational beings, we are creatures of desires, passions, and loves. He further contends that the way we change is not primarily a matter of the mind, but primarily the result of heart-shaping forces of the cultural liturgies we encounter in the world. He writes, quote, "Because our hearts are oriented primarily by desire, by what we love, and because those desires are shaped and molded by the habit-forming practices in which we participate, it is the rituals and practices of the mall, the liturgies of the mall and the market, that shape our imaginations and how we orient ourselves to the world. Embedded in them is a common set of assumptions about the shape of human flourishing, which becomes an implicit telos or goal of our own desires and actions. That is, the visions of the good life embedded in these practices become surreptitiously embedded in us through our participation in the rituals and rhythms of these institutions." Close quote. Throughout the following interview, Smith seeks to show the ways that cultural liturgies should be created and countered in classical Christian schools. Each interview segment will be briefly introduced. Those wishing to listen to each segment separately can do so by downloading the separate audio clips at insideclassicaled.com. Now here's Jamie Smith in the first segment as he addresses the issue of why every pedagogy must assume an anthropology. Here's Jamie Smith.
I was suggesting that every pedagogy assumes an anthropology. That is, every teaching strategy, every curricular program, even if it doesn't articulate it and make it explicit, implicitly is always assuming some picture of what human beings are. It's always assuming that students are some kinds of animals. And so to say that every pedagogy assumes an anthropology means that the way you teach is going to reflect what you think humans are for, what you think, what sorts of creatures you think human beings are. And I think what's going on in a classical Christian education is that it honors and recognizes a holistic, full-bodied picture of what human beings are, so that education can't just be the depositing of information into sort of an idea receptacle, into a willing mind, but that in fact it is the formation of character, habits, desires, longings, passions, and that's a full-orbed educational task. So if every pedagogy assumes an anthropology, then the converse is also true. Every anthropology entails a pedagogy. And I think what's going on in classical Christian education is the working out of an educational approach that honors and reflects a biblical understanding of human persons as lovers, as those who desire an Augustinian model that we love in order to understand, and therefore our education has to train our loves. And I think that's very unique in the contemporary educational marketplace, so to speak.
And now here's Jamie Smith as he discusses how humans are shaped and therefore how they're educated.
So if we wanted to think about this model of the human person as a lover, and how does that connect with the role of habit, ritual, and formation in education. The connection is that our loves are not givens, right? It is the case that human beings are made to love, and we can't not love. So we are always longing for something. We love something ultimately. But that love can take different directions. So our love is not hardwired. It's something that's formed. It's something that's primed. It's something that's aimed. And the way that our loves get aimed is precisely through the habit-forming rituals of social practices. So in some significant sense, an education has to be a panoply, a nexus of social practices, you could call them rituals, that are really aimed at directing or redirecting our love to a certain vision of human flourishing, what we're made for. Now, in fact, what I would say is every education is doing that, whether it realizes it or not. So it's important that we recognize even an education that thinks of itself as value neutral is not. Even if our pedagogical strategies think that they don't touch on character, they do. There's no education that's not training our loves. The question isn't whether you love, it's what you love. And the question isn't whether an education is forming our passions and desires and longings, it's to what end is an education forming our passions and desires and loves. And so something like a classical Christian education is trying to be very explicit and intentional in the goals that it's after in our education. But because it's articulating a particular vision of what we think human beings are made for, to love God, to desire His kingdom. That has to run counter then to all kinds of supposedly secular educations. I mean, in a way you can see that I don't think there is anything, there's no such thing as a secular education. Every education is religious because there's some sort of ultimate trumping identity forming feature of our education. And we are being formed to love some end, and I think we need to make explicit what those ends are in order to have a pedagogy that...
It is common for Christian educators to emphasize training in Christian worldview. Well, Jamie doesn't think that's all bad, but he does subject it to some careful analysis and suggests that it's not enough. Here's Jamie as he discusses that subject.
So I have some mild, friendly criticisms of Christian education that is framed in terms of a worldview. Not because I think it's wrong, but because I think it's insufficient. So if what has tended to happen with worldview language, and I don't think it has to go this way, but what has tended to happen is worldview has become a code for just naming a certain system of Christian beliefs. A nexus of Christian ideas and doctrines. And if you think that an education then is just the dissemination of that sort of system of beliefs, my concern is that your education's not going to touch the affective core where our passions and longings and loves are, which is what really drives so much of our being in the world. So my worry about the worldview approach is not that it's mistaken, but that it's inadequate. And if you just think a Christian education is getting the right Christian ideas in students' heads, not that there's anything wrong with that, but you need more than that if it's actually going to be formative. Because an education that's going to be formative has to be grabbing us at our gut, in our heart. And that is going to involve getting hold of students in ways that can't always be articulated. There's something inarticulable about catching the Christian story. And this is why I think part and parcel of that kind of approach to education is a significant place and role for, say, Christian worship and Christian liturgical practices, because there's a way in which the story of God reconciling the world to himself in Christ is carried in Christian worship practices in a way that is irreducible and implicit, that we can articulate to some degree, but there's also a kind of know-how that you're absorbing there at this gut level that you can never quite put into words. And I think that's important. I think that governs our relationship to the world more than we might think. So in Desiring the Kingdom, for instance, I make a distinction between knowledge and understanding. This is actually drawing on Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor. Knowledge is exactly that kind of articulated, explicit, you know, propositionalized aspects of Christian faith. And clearly we can do that. That's what Christian doctrine is. That's even what the creeds are in some ways. But there is then this more inchoate, tacit understanding of Christian faith that we absorb in spiritual disciplines, in Christian practices, in worship, that is just as, and sometimes I would even say more important than that. And you can't get it any other way. You can't just read the books that summarize the doctrines and absorb that understanding of the Christian faith. In fact, I think there's an analogy to be drawn here between liturgy and literature. And if you ask me what T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets means, any paraphrase I give you of that, it's not flying off into la-la land. I mean, it's still connected and it might be helpful in understanding, but it's never going to be the equivalent of absorbing the experience that is that poem. And I think in the same way, we can summarize the Christian faith and articulate it in propositions and doctrines and beliefs, but that will never be the same as kneeling to receive the Eucharist. There's something implicit and tacit in that know-how that I think is irreducible and shapes our understanding of the world in ways that we sometimes underappreciate.
In his book, Desiring the Kingdom, Jamie Smith talks a good deal about the formative influence of what he calls cultural liturgies. There are secular liturgies, and there are sacred ones. Here's Jamie discussing that subject.
I think some of the predominant love shapers, as you put it, I call them secular liturgies. These are sort of the competitors for our heart, the competitors for our affections. And in Desiring the Kingdom, I talk about the mall as one site of that, insofar as it is sort of an encapsulation of an entire consumerist gospel. But that gospel is carried in the practices of a consumerist ethos and environment. So to be immersed in the world of the mall is to be inserted into this tactile, kinetic ethos and environment that is communicating all kinds of very concrete visions of what human flourishing looks like. And it turns out human flourishing looks like having sort of the right J. Crew clothes and the right new electronic gadgets that accessorize that. What's really germane here is that that's promised to be happiness. That's what we're made for. And I think it's a gospel with diminishing returns, which is why it turns into this incessant search, and the disquieted heart of Augustine can be seen all over that. So I think consumerism is carried in so many of the practices of our culture, and it's not something that we're ever convinced of intellectually. It's something that we absorb at this more effective level. Another one, though, I think that we should consider is the university itself. I think the university is a very powerful secular liturgy. And I think actually one of the best diagnoses of that is Tom Wolfe's novel, harrowing novel, I Am Charlotte Simmons, which sort of documents the life of, D1 Duke-like, UNC-like university. And what's interesting for those of us who are educators is, I mean, when we think of the university, we think research, library, classroom. It turns out that's not what students think of when they think of going to university. And in fact, the most powerful liturgies of the university are not academic. They're frat houses, they are athletic events, they are dormitories, they are tailgate parties. There's all kinds of implicit but nonetheless powerful communications of sort of what the world is for in those practices. And so when I analyze the university, what I'm interested in is all the extracurricular liturgies that so captivate an imagination. And in Wolfe's novel, as you may know, I mean, it really documents the decline of this aspiring, wonderfully intellectual aspiring girl, Charlotte Simmons, who within a year has been hooked by these secular liturgies, which operate on her body, right? So she comes in sort of over-evaluating the significance of her intellect and not realizing how important the body is at the university. I think that's a very... none of this, by the way, is meant to be sort of anti-university. It's just to sort of open our eyes up to the formative power of those spaces. I think there are all kinds of analyses. I do think there's something about social media that is primed to sort of shape our orientation to the world. For some people, the culture of the gym, the health club, is a deeply formative ritual that actually is, it's not a ritual just because they do it every day. It's actually changing what they think it is to be human, what they think happiness is. So I think this gives us a new lens to think about the challenges and competition of education.
The formative and shaping power that cultural liturgies have upon us is something that Jamie will discuss in this next clip. He'll also explore the ways in which we can counter the power that these liturgies have upon us. Here's Jamie on that subject.
So how could we prevent the I Am Charlotte Simmons slide, so to speak? I think that's a really great question. There are a couple things come to mind. One is, a few things. First of all, just waking up to the realities of what's going on there. So not being Charlotte Simmons, which is thinking, oh, well, the university is all about the mind. I really want to learn. Therefore, she goes in completely inattentive to all the bodily ritualized temptations that go along with that. So in a way, I think just kind of showing people that there is a secular liturgy at work at the university is a first step to sort of defanging that. Secondly, you need to enact countermeasures, right? So what you have to do is you have to counter the liturgies of the university with counterformative Christian practices. So this is where I think it's absolutely crucial that the students who go to college, which is a very disruptive experience, and Christian Smith's work on youth spirituality has shown us how disruptive that move from high school to college can be. I think we need to help our young people find ways to get plugged into communities of practice that will sustain them to help nourish that. I think it's, by the way, I think it's one of the real problems with Wolfe's novel is that he doesn't give Charlotte any connection to a community of religious practice that would have functioned as a countermeasure. And if Charlotte's coming from Sparta, North Carolina, and seems to come from sort of a Christian home, I would expect, actually, that she would have tried to find, although not necessarily, would it have gone differently if she was immersed in a different community of practice that was a counterweight and a countermeasure to that? This is why I think one of the things that the church should really be investing in or thinking about is not going to those schools, but what would it look like for us to create residential communities at those schools that would sustain a discipled life? I don't think Young Life and Campus Crusade are doing it. I don't think InterVarsity is doing it. I think it takes a bigger vision of a real residential community. You're starting to see around the country sort of study houses that are also residential, intentional communities. I think that would be a great strategy for dealing with that.
In this next clip, Jamie Smith urges us to be careful not to unwittingly be importing secular liturgies into our own educational approach.
I do think it's a fair concern that Christian education has to constantly be taking stock of what it's doing, so that it doesn't just end up offering a Jesusified version of whatever current secular pedagogy looks like. By Jesusified, I mean you basically take off the shelf whatever the paradigms are in education today and say, well, but we're going to add Christian content to that. I think that's a recipe for failure, because what we won't realize is that those pedagogies that we are taking off the shelf are already primed to some telos, to some vision of human flourishing that might be quite antithetical to what we are trying to achieve in the Christian formation of students. So, and I think that sort of assimilation happens often under the rubric of excellence. So what we say is, well, we're offering a Christian education, but we're also committed to excellence. And excellence means we're going to do it the way everybody else does, and we're going to add Jesus. Whereas I think a Christian education has to be rooted in a very radically different vision, so that from the ground up you're building from Christian commitments. I do think the other way that Christian education has been assimilated to the culture is precisely because it's gotten sucked into the culture wars. If Christian education is really just a code for playing some sort of ideological politics or some sort of partisan battle, A, I think we're doing a disservice to our students, but B, I think we are underestimating how much we've just sold the farm. Because we're instrumentalizing Christian education to something else that's really more ultimate. And I think a Christian education should be inviting students to see themselves as part of the people of God, which then should make them ambivalent about all the ideologies currently on offer. And I think one of the successes of a Christian education will be just to the extent, not that students are taught to withdraw from engagement in our culture, but actually they come to have a very healthy ambivalence about both ends of the political spectrum in some ways. And so I worry sometimes a Christian education is just a cover for a certain kind of politicized education, or it's a reaction to some other politicized form of education. And I think that's the least creative way to enter into the Christian educational project.
In the next discussion, Jamie Smith explores the way he thinks that the church can serve as a model and resource for classical Christian education.
Yeah, the church is really important for my vision of education because, in a way, what we're doing Monday to Friday with students has to be buoyed and embedded, buoyed by and embedded in the wider body of Christ and the household of God, and has to be nourished by, in particular, the practices that we inherit from the church in terms of liturgical practice, worship practices, spiritual disciplines. So I think the challenge for Christian education is whether there exists the churches that would be necessary to really pull it off. If you disconnect the Christian school from the church, what happens is sometimes the school becomes a substitute church. But then you've got a problem because there's still always just a particular profile in general of the folks that are going to be part of this school. And you're not going to have the rich intergenerational realities of the congregations that we're coming from. So I think the church teaches the school the fundamentals of the narrative over and over and over and over again. So the gathered congregations, worship, and sacraments is how we are, all of us, invited into the story of what God is doing in the world. And it's what keeps anchoring and tethering us to that story. It's also where we draw our practices from. I mean, I think one of the things Christian schools can do is try to think about how to extend and extrapolate from the inherited Christian practices we receive from the church to say, how could this shape the shape of Christian education? I mean, this is where, I think our Catholic brothers and sisters have a church polity that makes room for this because the parochial school is part of the diocese, do you know? And there's a sort of seamless web. Some of us who come from Protestant tradition, we have habits of compartmentalization that tend to silo these things, whereas I think ideally there does have to be a seamless flow between them.
And now here's Jamie Smith as he talks about why he thinks that pastors will be or should be interested in classical Christian education.
So if I'm a pastor who has come to appreciate, let's say, the wisdom of historic Christian practices and historic Christian worship, then I think classical Christian education seems like the logical complement to that task. Because both of those are countering the chronological snobbery of our contemporary culture and the cult of the novel. So the new, the next best thing, right? So to be a congregation that values historic Christian practices and the wisdom that we inherit from the great tradition is to have a stance towards history and the Spirit's work in history that already makes you actually submit to the tradition, right? So you don't think just because I live in 2011 that I'm smarter. In fact, I still feel like I'm constantly trying to catch up to St. Augustine. Well, in a way, I see classical education is sort of hinged on that same sort of commitment, that there is a pedagogical tradition that is ancient and medieval that has so much contemporary relevance. Not, and we're not adapting it to be relevant. We're saying that the ancient wisdom of this practice is directly relevant, equipping the people of God to be the people of God for a contemporary culture. And also to sort of resist some of the unique temptations of a contemporary culture. So classical Christian education needs churches to have that sensibility. And then I think churches that have that sensibility would find the logical expression of that in the educational vision of classical Christian education.
What's lacking in secular education? Here's Jamie Smith as he addresses that subject.
So I think secular education, on the one hand, has vaulted aspirations. On the other hand, it has de facto made a decision to enclose itself in the flattened world of immanence, right? So on the one hand, it wants to arrogate to itself all kinds of aspirations, but it can never really pierce the brass heaven and have genuine transcendence. And because of that, I think a secular education flattens the world. And it leads to just the kind of reductionisms that we are often trying to resist. And then I actually think human beings, given the kinds of creatures that we are always constantly uncomfortable with, even when they dominate the culture of which we're a part. And so I think there is something in our being, there's something in our makeup that's always going to push against that closure of a secular education that flattens the world, that disenchants the world, that empties the world. And we can't ever quite get away from this penchant we have for longing for transcendence, for what Charles Taylor calls fullness. You can never sort of erase that, even if we have all these powerful pedagogies that would want to. And so what happens then is something like Christian education, which starts from a very different anthropology and doesn't reduce us down to these meaty, you know, naturalistic biological machines, but recognizes that we are characterized by this depth and this transcendence. It's that kind of Christian education that assumes that kind of anthropology sort of plucks strings that we didn't know we had, but it sort of wakes us up to a reality, and it's like, oh yeah, this is what I'm made for. This is what I'm made for. And I think that's the wager of the project of Christian education in some ways, and of a classical Christian education, is to honor the fullness of who we are as, well, as what Christian Smith calls moral believing animals. Any education that doesn't honor the fact that we are moral creatures, that we are creatures of faith, and that we are narratival, storytelling animals is never going to adequately account for our experience, for the kinds of beings that we always sense ourselves to be.
In this next clip, Jamie Smith probes a bit further into the question of what is a human being and discusses three functional anthropologies that we've inherited and how they relate to education.
So I think one of the things that's we could diagnose that we've inherited in our cultural moment are what we could call some functional anthropologies, some functional models of the human person, some of which we inherited from modernity. So they have sort of recent provenance, you know, in the history of human thought. And From the Enlightenment, from modernity, we inherit this model of the human person as a thinker. Now, not just that we think, but that, in fact, we are defined by what we think, that we are minds, that we are thinking things, that the core and essence of who we are is the intellect. Without wanting to deny that that's a part of a feature of who we are, If you sort of overestimate that, if you absolutize that, you will actually end up with a reductionistic picture of the human person. So some then Christian theorists, even a century ago, pointed out and said, "Well, look, we're not just thinking things; we are actually believing things. We're not just thinkers; we're believers." And that's kind of what the worldview approach to Christian education is saying: is look, there's no neutral, objective thought about the world. All of our thinking about the world is informed and contextualized by what we believe about the world. There's a worldview that precedes our reason. We believe in order to understand. That's also true. That sounds just right. But we're also more than that, too. So if you just had a model of education that emphasized not just thinking but also believing, I still think you would have a stunted, truncated anthropology that you're working with. Because then St. Augustine would emphasize, in order for you to believe well and to think rightly, you actually have to love in the right order. Your loves, your affections. Jonathan Edwards, the great American theologian Jonathan Edwards, would say the same thing. You need rightly ordered affections to be the context and the seedbed for right believing and right thinking. And so an educational project that just deals with the intellect is okay, that's a great starting point, but that's a piece of us. One that addresses our belief structures and systems, great, that's an improvement, but still not the whole deal. The most holistic education is going to be one that addresses and grabs hold of our affections, our loves, our passions, and orients those, trains those towards the end of human flourishing that our narrative articulates as the ideal. And I think it's exactly that kind of full-orbed holism that classical Christian education is trying to get after.
Jamie Smith is a professor of philosophy and has thought a good deal about, and even written about, postmodernism. Is postmodernism an opportunity for classical Christian education? Here's Jamie.
So yeah, in a strange way, I think postmodernism is a gift and opportunity for the church. And I think I think postmodernism is a gift and an opportunity for the church, and I think it creates an ethos and a context in which it makes sense to recover the intuitions of classical Christian education for just this reason. I mean, we could say more about it, but if at base postmodernism as a philosophical movement, not as a cultural, you know, set of trends that everybody texts everybody, but postmodernism as a kind of philosophical sensibility, is, I would say, characterized by a deep and radical and trenchant critique of a lot of the assumptions of modernity. So postmodernism is the critique of modernity. And in particular, it's a critique of the intellect, the rationalism of modernity, the social atomism of modernity. You know, a lot of those ideals of the sort of individual, isolated, autonomous thinking thing self. Well, it turns out Christians should share a lot of those criticisms. And so postmodernism then is an ally for us in pointing out the paucity and the reductionism of that kind of those modernist habits of mind that we acquired. The problem, of course, though, is that the church so quickly bought modernity, hook, line, and sinker. And therefore, when postmodernism comes along and criticizes modernity, we are so in bed with that that postmodernism feels like a criticism of the church. It is a just criticism of the church to the extent to which it has assimilated itself to modernity, but it can also be a catalyst for us to remember what it looks like for the people of God to be a communal social polis, a body that had not bought into those modern assumptions. So for my money, and actually this is my pilgrimage, it was through reading people like Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, and Jean-François Lyotard that actually brought me to the point of starting to see why I should care about pre-modern wisdom and traditions and practices. So I have these deep ancient and Catholic sensibilities because of contemporary atheistic French philosophers, but it's because they pointed out to me what I had unwittingly taken on board in modernity. So that's why, in a way, I think the future of Christianity in the postmodern era is historic, orthodox, full-orbed, small-c Catholic Christianity. That fits well, I think, then, with the intuitions of classical Christian education. In other words, this is a way of making sense of why classical Christian education is not just late modern nostalgia. There are versions of classical Christian education which I think are versions of late modern nostalgia, or sort of longing for some sort of lost paradise of, I don't know, American education or something. I don't think that's a helpful way to frame it. But I think there can be creative, constructive appropriations of the classical tradition for contemporary witness. And that's, it seems to me, what makes a perhaps strange bedfellows between postmodern philosophy and classical Christian education.
And now here's Jamie Smith as he discusses the relationship between recent developments in neuroscience and character formation.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how contemporary cognitive science, neuroscience, a lot of work in psychology now is sort of proving Aristotle right and proving Aquinas right. Because what we are getting now is basically a sort of an empirical account of why habits, practices, imitation all have deeply formative roles in shaping our orientation to the world. It's kind of like what we're getting is the science of character. And from the appreciation of, say, mirror neurons, which prime us to want to imitate those who are in front of us, which then explains Aristotle's account of that if I want to learn to be virtuous, one of the best things I can do is imitate the virtuous person who's the model and exemplar of that. In contemporary psychology, we have a renewed appreciation, or a new appreciation, for the a kind of unconscious, which is not a Freudian unconscious, but just the sense that so much of our being in the world, so much of our action in the world, is governed by automated behaviors which we don't really think through, we don't deliberate about, which we acquired through repetitive practice, and then get sort of inscribed into our automated processes, so now that we can go about our day reflecting on a small bit of what we do, and the rest sort of runs on its own. Not because it's hardwired, but because we've absorbed that into our automated consciousness. I think that just helps explain and maybe prompts us to take seriously the role of repetitive, shared, embodied social practices as part of the strategy of an education, which is ultimately a pedagogy of desire. That's trying to train and orient our loves. I mean, I don't think we have to do that because scientists are now shown us to. It's just sort of confirmed the wisdom of the ancient tradition for us in a new way. Yeah.
In this next clip, Jamie Smith discusses the way that classical Christian education should be holistic and reflect the diversity of God's creation. Here's Jamie.
So I think ideally a Christian education, and therefore a classical Christian education, should encourage and reflect all the rich diversity of God's creation. So if what we're trying to do is equip students and propel students to be curious about every nook and cranny of God's world, then there would be, in a way, no sector of our experience in the world of which God doesn't say, that's mine, and therefore it's worthy of study. So obviously there are sort of, you know, core disciplines of the liberal arts that we inherit, and those, but in the best model, it seems to me in the most holistic model of a curriculum, that's also going to include not just classic humanities disciplines, but also careful empirical attention to God's world that we see in the sciences, in the sort of calculative possibilities of mathematics. And what we would be doing is embedding and situating those investigations in terms of, well, why do we want to learn that? On the one hand, you're learning something about God's world, but the question is also, in what way can this equip us to unfold the potential in God's creation? See, I'm working with a model which says God created us to be his image bearers. And what that means is he's commissioned us to be culture makers. And what that means is it's as if when creation comes to be and it's laden, it's packed with all this potential. Creation doesn't come ready-made with art museums and farms and hospitals and, football stadiums. Those are all potentialities that need to be unpacked by the work of human culture making. And what we are called to do is to make culture well, to make culture in a way that is ordered to what God's vision of human flourishing is. And so the maths and sciences are part of that cultural project. The arts are part of that cultural project. I also, in my model, actually, the arts get kind of a little bit of a privileged place because if the way we train our heart, if our loves are primed because they, our imaginations are converted, are captured, then in fact it's exactly the aesthetic that does that so powerfully. It's exactly the affective and aesthetic picturing of flourishing that will tend to capture our imagination. And so there's a really important role for the arts to play in unfolding God's world for us. There's also a role that the arts play in showing us the brokenness of God's world. You know, I think art tells the truth differently and uniquely. And some of the arts are going to be arts of lament and will make us be confronted with the brokenness of our world and its need for redemption in ways that my just dissertation on that topic is not going to do. So again, there are irreducibilities there that if you lost any piece of those, it's like you would be spurning a corner of God's creation, it seems to me.
In this final clip, Jamie Smith offers some advice to administrators of classical Christian schools and encourages them to pay careful attention to not only the curricular, but the co-curricular.
So I think the challenge for administrators of classical Christian schools, or not challenge, the opportunity, is they have to play the role of seeing the big picture and cultivating the whole ethos, right? Because the vision of education that we're talking about here says that education is not just happening in classrooms. It is, it's a package, and it's the co-curricular that is as important as the curricular. And I think so far classical Christian education has spent a lot of time reflecting on the curricular, right? That comes with the territory. And I think there's also been, classical Christian education has inherited practices that are part of the co-curricular. And I would just encourage administrators to continue taking sort of a practices audit of the ethos of a school and asking, how are our functional liturgies aimed at the kingdom? And how are they not? And where are the pockets where we are sort of lacking appropriate practices? And where are the pockets where we have still unwittingly adopted secular practices, off-the-shelf practices that maybe deserve a little bit more radical critique? Administrators can't pull that off on their own. That will require the whole community. But they can be, it seems to me, the catalysts for doing that kind of work. To classical Christian teachers, I would say thank you. And I would encourage them to not underestimate the power of their modeling, the formative role that they will play when students imitate them. I guess I would warn them about that too. But there is a sense in which I know, even as an educator, my classroom is one tiny little sphere of a college education. And I know I don't control the big picture. I want to influence the big picture as much as I can, but I also just need to be faithful to what I'm doing in my classroom. And I shouldn't overestimate it, because then you sort of set yourself up for failure, right? And I don't think that's helpful. I think it's better to have sort of appropriately magnanimous understandings of what you can accomplish as a teacher in your classroom. And it seems to me one of the most encouraging places to think about that is the role that you can play as an exemplar. And I also think sort of being devoted to continuing education will continue to fertilize our imaginations for ourselves, so that we can be trying to capture their imaginations with the same vision. I think the more and more I teach, the more I'm convinced that friendship is central to that project. So I have a deep sense that I cannot be a teacher on my own. And I think, and maybe this is where administrators can also help, is just encouraging communities of practice that foster friendship. That, it seems to me, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, everybody agrees, is the condition of possibility for pulling this off. And I think we could do no better than just invest in that.
And that will conclude the interview with James K.A. Smith on classical education. We'd like to extend our thanks to the Geneva School of Orlando, which hosted this interview with James K.A. Smith in October of 2010. And once again, all the clips from this interview can be listened to separately by downloading them from the website at insideclassicaled.com. This is Christopher Perrin with Inside Classical Ed. Thank you for listening.